Grandpa's just going to love the fruitcake I baked.
I hate fruitcake.
Now stop.
Nothing personal. It gives me gas. Can't we just eat something else?
Now stop. You know it's Grandpa's favorite. And Grandpapa loves our company. Grandpa, we're here.
Oh, he's probably still in the can.
Oh my God. Grandpa.
Great. Now we have a fruitcake to eat and a dead body. Maybe we can scoop bits of fruitcake down his mouth. I mean, doesn't the digestive tract still work a few hours after the body's dead?
You insensitive bastard! Can't you see he's dead?
I may be insensitive, but I'm not cleaning up this mess.
Well, you don't have to! Tired of contending with the stinky remains of a dead relative? Well, why not consider Po-Sin's Fearless Cleanup Avengers? Our skilled team of professional cleaners will make it look like dear old grandma never plopped dead in an untidy swamp of her own bodily fluids. Po-Sin understands that death represents a terrible cost to friends and loved ones. But more importantly, well, someone will get stuck with one hell of a carpet cleaning bill. Let Po-Sin take care of the mess, so the only thing you'll have to cry over is the body lovingly touched up at the mortuary.
Okay, so I am here once again with Charlie Houston, most recently the man behind the mystic arts of erasing all signs of death. Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. First off, I have to ask you about your concern for location. I mean, it's there in the Joe Pitt books. However, I noticed in this book you're starting to be a little bit more specific about the particular details. I know that, for example, you have Jim's Burgers in this, which is a real place, where you have Jaime eating a really crappy burger, an aging Mortal Kombat machine in the back of the diner. But given how dialogue-driven your prose is, and given how plot-driven and the momentum essentially just keeps going, I'm curious as to whether this represents an effort on your part to just kind of enhance some of the details, because I notice you're getting a little bit closer in those details,
right.
And what is the exact formula? Because you're dealing with these other elements as well.
Sure. So there's a couple things. You know, in terms of using real locations, that's something I've been doing since the very first book. You know, it's like, and part of that is just that I'm not terribly imaginative. So I tend to use what's close at hand.
Yeah.
And then to the extent that the mystic art specifically is a little bit more fleshed out in specific details, physical details of place, and to a further extent, the way that emotions are a little bit more fleshed out and commented on, that was really conscious, and it's part of why I chose to do a book in first person past tense,
yeah,
rather than first person present tense, which most of the other books had been, and specifically kind of designed a character who would have who would be interesting in commenting on the action as it happened and make these observations, mm-hmm. because he's telling the story after it's concluded. He's got the time and the option to do that. Whereas when you're, you know, I sit down, I pick up the coffee, you know, blah, 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 blah. When you're doing it that way, present tense, you really can't, you know, there's very little, you know, and you end up with some very awkward sentence structures when you try to, you know, describe somebody's, you know, he sits down across from me, leather jacket, you know, brain would not die t-shirt. It gets hard, but Webb can do that in the past tense. And it was part of a large, it's ultimately going to touch on so many areas if I go into it at length about this. So let's leave it at third person, opens it up and it gives you the luxury of doing some of that.
Well, it's funny you mentioned sentences because it does, I think, come down to that. You were mentioning awkward sentence structure. In fact, there was one sentence from the book that struck me. It was in relation to an entirely different matter, and I'll read it. It's, "Stripped to my underwear, a pair of sneakers and rubber gloves, I took down the white pillowcases I had hung over the kitchen windows to keep the morning sunlight from pouring in when I used to get up early and have my coffee before going off to teach kids how to read and write and add and subtract." That's fascinating on a couple of levels because, first of all, the verbs kind of get mangled in that particular structure, but simultaneously there's another kind of sentence in which you do the run-on of several short sequential actions, essentially compartmentalized together with that wonderful "and" that you like to use. And so I must ask, in relation to this concern over detail, whether to you this long sentence is a kind of ideal prose style for you to get at this fleshing out of emotions, fleshing out of details and the like, and whether these are the two types of ideal long sentences that you're using right now, or these are the two types of long sentences that, well, at the present time, as you're writing, these are your long sentences.
It's easier to answer about the action sequences,
yeah.
And that's just a matter of maintaining a certain amount of momentum. You know, there are, you know, it is ultimately a gimmick, you know, and it's hardly one that is original to me, or that, you know, there's lots of people that use the long run-on sentence, you know, when they come to a sequence of action. And then it's a matter of, in terms of structuring a specific one, it's a matter of how many separate individual actions there are within it, and then I might use the ands to create beats and also to kind of create a build within that. Other times I want it to spill more, so there's, you know, there's more commas. With something like that, I don't know, you know, sometimes I just start a sentence and I just get tangled up in it. And sometimes it works, you know. Sometimes it's a nice little tune, and it floats along, and it's built well. It just incidentally, and it carries the eye through it, and it carries the mind through it, and everything's fine. And other times it's just awkward. And because all of these books really are written so quickly because of my schedule, I don't edit a whole lot, you
yeah.
know, so some of these things that, you know, become stylistic fingerprints are, you know, are not consciously thought through. You know, the style is still evolving, and but I've talked a lot in the past about the fact that a lot of the style is evolving because of the schedule, because
yeah,
of the
because
way
of
that
the
I
time
write.
Compression
yeah,
factors.
Yeah. So there are just things that slip through the cracks. So, like, I hear you read that sentence, and I'm like thinking to myself, when's this going to end, and where is it going to get to a point? And I'd need to see it in the context on the page. I mean, I remember the scene, but I'd have to kind of like remember exactly where Webb is and in the story, and how yeah. much has been revealed to the reader at that point about his past, to be able to say whether, hearing it just read aloud like that, I go, that's kind of messy, man. I could have done better than that. I could have chopped that in half, you know,
yeah.
something like that. So.
Well, I mean, I'm curious why those particular details in that sentence mesh together in that particular way, as opposed to the sequence A and sequence B,
right.
or sequence C, et cetera. I mean, what happened there? Was it just a question of meeting a deadline, or was it a scenario in which the rhythm for that particular moment involved this mangling that you're now
right.
criticizing?
I don't know what was... this is the thing. It's hard to even fathom where I was in the writing at that point. I mean, I know he's cleaning a murder scene. You
yeah.
know, he's cleaning up something, a murder scene in his own home. He's come to a kind of, you know, to one of many kind of crisis points in the story, where he's kind of confronting what has become of his life. Why I transitioned out of him simply describing the physical actions necessary to begin the cleaning process, and it segued into a remembrance of what his life used to be like, you know, at the point where he takes down the sheets, which triggers whatever in him, remembering what his mornings used to be like and what his life used to be like. I don't know. I don't know if I just don't remember if I was thinking at the point, well, I want to touch on, in this moment, the midst of this, I want to touch on his past, or if I was just writing that sentence and I got to the pillowcases, and the pillowcases led to the morning, and the morning led to what he used to do. I just don't know, man.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about this last time when we talked, this notion of the rhythm, but one thing I didn't quite get out of you, and I want to actually put it to you again,
sure.
is the idea of the alternating sentences. Often a repetition, such as motherfucker, which you're, of course, you're very fond of. It makes me, of course, ask whether motherfucker is one of those words that taints you in your dreams, or bothers you, or vexes you, and just calls out to be repeated and laced line by line. But what of this notion of rhythm? Are there certain words like motherfucker or yeah that really demand this alternating sentence structure?
Well, something like words like yeah or so or hey or man or well or, you know, I mean, you know, or, you know, these are just vocal utterances. These are just the brain's moments where the words are catching up, you know, the thoughts are catching up to the words, or vice versa. And they're just typical of speech. So when I'm composing dialogue, and I don't compose dialogue as much as I just kind of imagine conversations and then write them, I hear a lot, so a word like yeah will come up a lot because that's just a very typical, you know, thing for people to say. Not a whole lot of people say a nice, clean, precise yes. Mm-hmm. Motherfucker, I don't, you know, I curse a lot. What can I say? Yeah. This is just a part of my, everybody I know curses a lot pretty much. All of my social circle is vulgar. Specifically in Mystic Arts, it became a thing for Po Sin, who uses it to punctuate moments of extreme frustration, you know. And then there it became a specific kind of gag where it's, you know, he early in the book he says something, and then there are just these kind of explosions that he had when something's going on. And sometimes they come a little bit out of left field. The first you know that he's upset is he says, "Motherfucker."
Yeah.
I don't know if I understand exactly what it is that you're asking about rhythm or about the use or...
Like, for example, there's a moment late in the book in which you repeat the word heartbeat 3 times, alternating it with another sentence.
Sure.
In fact, I would say this book has more of those alternating repetitions where you have one line, heartbeat, next line, something else.
Right.
Third line, heartbeat. But there's also something you do, and that is you have a character command another character to do something, and then you have the next sentence and the next line essentially be, that character did this.
Right.
And I'm curious as to why this repetition emerges. Does it emerge in response to a previous sentence? This is what I didn't really kind of get from you last time. Or is it something where a word like motherfucker, or yeah, or web, or boy, or hey, is one of those things that essentially taunts you and you twist and turn in your bed and you must go ahead and compose this onto paper?
No, it doesn't twist and turn me in bed, so I can eliminate that right now.
Okay.
There's no haunting going on.
Good troubleshooting.
The heartbeat sequence was just kind of a, you know, that was a moment that I did spend a fair amount of time on that I tinkered with a bit and about how those words should be layered. And it's that, you know, sometimes I want to get across the pace of something without the character having to describe the pace of it. Mm-hmm. So that was really all that was. And then there's also something about the word heartbeat, you know, it immediately evokes a certain level of emotion and passion and feeling, you know. There are these inferences that can be, you know, drawn from it, from the reader about how deeply something is being felt at the moment it's happening. So it's, you know, it's a moment when Webb is making a conscious choice to put his life at risk to protect somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I wanted it to have that, because it's him addressing this, you know, tragedy that's kind of at the heart of why he's doing, living his life the way he's living, and this is the moment where he's kind of coming face to face with that and trying to do what he couldn't do in the past. I wanted it to be clear that he was making very conscious decisions, and also to do something that was a little bit cinematic, which was to kind of freeze the moment in the reader's mind. So there'd be the feeling almost of everything around him stopping as he moves in the midst of this. Mm-hmm. So that was what was going on there. And I just don't know. I mean, you can ask this question as many different ways as you want to, and I just don't know if I'm going to have just a general response about it. This is just the way I write is really what it is. I like the way it sounds. I like the beats. When you're talking about something like, say, you know, he told me to go in there and scrub the sink, so I got up and I went in there and I scrubbed the sink. You know, sometimes, I mean, I'm just telling the story, you know, so sometimes it's just as simple as, well, he told him to, but you still got to say whether or not the character actually does it.
Yes.
If I use the, sometimes there's a little, sometimes if you use the same words, you can put a little tinkle of irony into it. Mm-hmm. In the fact that you describe him doing it exactly the way the person just told him, so you use the exact same words. It's hard for me to answer questions about the writing that are that that precise,
yeah,
because so much of the process is not that precise for me. So much of it is shoveling, you know, and you're not too terribly conscious of how you shovel while you're doing it, whether you're good at it or not.
But you just confessed to me that the heartbeat sequence
one, yes, absolutely. But in general, I'm saying that, like, if you're asking general kind of questions about the way I use rhythm or use repetitions and stuff, I can draw out an example like that where it was very specific, but and that I had very particular goals that I'm articulating now in much more depth than I ever articulated them to myself at the time. But in terms of being able to generally say why those rhythms appeal to me, why I use them, I don't know. You know, I'm kind of making it up right now the same way as I make it up when I write it. You know, I'm like, well, I think it works like this, but does it, you know? So that's kind of where I am with that stuff.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is interesting to me because you have such restrictive deadlines, and here you are working over specific sequences. This is why I'm kind of interested in how you're developing your rhythm,
sure,
even with these constricting conditions, you know?
Well, may also just be part of it, you know, you know, some of those things... you know, Ed, I just don't know, man. I mean, that's really the bottom line. I don't know how far I can penetrate into this and have it not just be bullshit at a certain point. It's just coming out that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's just coming out that way. And I don't know if the time frame has as much to do with it. The time frame tends to play more into things that slip through the crack that might be messy, like that long sentence that you had, and how it's a combination of I find myself making connections that I might not otherwise make because I'm writing clip, 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 and also it might be a situation where I find myself writing sloppy things that I might otherwise clean up if I had more time. The time constriction tends to manifest more in pushing the story forward very aggressively, sometimes, you know, I think we've talked about this in the past, sometimes making choices that 50 pages later I wish I hadn't made because I had implications I hadn't considered, but I don't have time to go back and unchoose that choice, so I have to, you know, do some more tap dancing to make it all work. And it also plays a large role in the extent to which I will more willingly embrace some genre conventions and cliches that I might otherwise try to find ways to steer around if I had a little bit more time. But sometimes you just, like, you're at a place and you're just like, I've done it before, which is really tired. Other people having done it before doesn't bother me too much. Me having done it before kind of wears on me a little bit sometimes. But, you know, sometimes you need it. You just need to get the story done. Also, sometimes you just need a way to shorthand a scene or a relationship or something. So sometimes you just need to get it across to the reader. You need to get it across quickly and efficiently. And I know that my readership is primarily a genre readership, so I know that A, they're game regardless, and B, I know they speak the lingo, so I can get away with that. So that's where the deadlines tend to have more of an influence when I think about how that presses things.
But you're talking also earlier about how much you can, in fact, get away with it. You mentioned to me that you don't know how further you can evolve with this particular formula. You expressed a desire early on, hey, I want to expand the emotions, I want to expand the rhythm. I mean, clearly there's an effort here to evolve.
Well, there are places where I'm doing it. I did it, Shotgun Rule moved out of first-person present tense into third-person multiple points of view, you know, I mean, still present tense, but that was completely different from what I had done before. The number of genre conventions that were in that book were way reduced. I mean, it was still a violent story, but I don't think that anybody would describe that. It had noirish elements, but I don't think anybody would describe it as noir in the way you would describe the Hank Thompson trilogy or the Joe Pitt books, which were all I had done up to that point. I feel like the Mystic Arts adheres to a lot of of a lot of noir conventions. You know, there's the femme fatale, you know, with, you don't know which side she's on. There's the guy who stumbles across the crime. There's a little bit of play of high and low of the, you know, protagonist moving between the, you know, the wealthy and the poor. There's the tragic, you know, incident in his past that kind of incites, and there's the supporting cast that you, you know, with a shadowy history. And of course it's set in Los Angeles, and that plays a big, you know, that's all classically noir. But again, I think it's only loosely neo-noir this time. There's, and obviously, as I said, I wanted to play with past tense to give, not just the narrative, so that I could write a narrator who could comment on the actions, which means that I could comment on the action.
Yeah.
And be, have the, you know, whereas in the past, I'm always a little bit surprised when people think that the books are more funny than they are dark.
We are, actually.
I know, but, and that's...
Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not, you know, conscious with most of the stuff. You know, most of the time I'm writing this stuff in what is earnest for me, you know, which turns out to be really funny for a lot of people. This was a book where I wanted to have room to be funny in a different way. I wanted to nudge a little bit more and poke and say, see? Just as a kind of way to loosen up for myself. In terms of expanding emotionally, this book goes into emotional, it's still very much generic emotional space, because it goes from this kind of, you know, the hard-bitten, stoic expressions of emotion that are, you know, particularly prevalent in Joe Pitt, but even in the Hank Thompson books, into blatant sentimentality, you know, into a character who's, you know, using his smart ass, you know, for a shield. But there's one of the other things I wanted to do in this is I wanted to, you know, have some warmth. I wanted to have a guy who was, you know, who really wanted to love and, you know, and to heal people. And I wanted to do something with a character where instead his life was falling apart, he was, you know, putting his life together. So, and then the book that I'm finishing up right now, I've taken far longer on than any previous book. And that will go even further into different territory. So I feel like I'm doing that, and I definitely still have that desire. And soon it's going to be forced upon me whether I want it or not, because I'm going to finish up, I'm going to write the fifth, I'm in the process of writing the fifth and final Joe Pitt book, and once that's gone, I'm going to be writing one book a year, whether that's my plan or not. So I'm going to have ample time to masturbate all over the page, you know. woe betide the reader. You know, who knows if that's going to work.
Well, I should also point out, in striving for this emotional territory, this was the first book I think I've read of yours in which a dog didn't have something terrible happen to it.
That's not true. There were. I cut out the. It was, and it wasn't always dogs. It was, in the first book, it was cat. It went. Cat, dog, and then I think by. I don't think anything happened to any dogs or animals in Half the Blood of Brooklyn. I don't think I heard any dogs in Dangerous Man. I wouldn't say that my animal maiming past is behind me, but no, this was not the first one. Absolutely not. I don't think I even did a dog even turn up in this story. I think I may have left it alone. I've got a line in the manuscript I just turned in where the character says he's on a property, and he's watching the security on the property, and he's talking about how he hopes there aren't any dogs, because dogs are fast and they're small targets and they're hard to hit with the first shot. And I just kind of, I wasn't thinking about it when I wrote it, but I just realized that I kind of foreshadowed that I was going to kill more animals in that book, but no dogs appear, so.
I'm wondering, though, if the reduction in animal violence or violence, or rather the motivation of violence, which I saw a lot more motivated violence in this, has caused you, I suppose, with this new emotional terrain that you're trying to explore in this particular book, whether the, you know, I mean, I don't know, this seemed less violent than...
Consciously so, yeah, intentionally so. This was another, it was all part and parcel, and this is what I was getting at when you asked your very first question.
Yeah.
That if I talk too much about the structure and stuff, I was going to end up answering all your questions right away, because this there were so many things that I set out to do with the book, and some of them were the stylistic things to tell a different type of story, but a huge chunk of the universal motivation for this book was at the time I started this, I had written the Hank Thompson trilogy, which ain't a happy story. I was in the process of writing the Joe Pitt books, which are high concept and, you know, heightened reality and stuff, but pitch black. And I had written Shotgun Rule with it, which ain't a happy story. And even if you've got a darkish nature, and even if you enjoy dark stories, which I do, and even if that's your natural bent is toward the bittersweet or the, you know, the lamentable, it wears. I wanted to write something lighter. I wanted to write something that wore its heart on its sleeve. I wanted to write something that was... I wasn't overly concerned about making it more accessible for a wider readership, but I didn't want to be necessarily beating up my readers as much as I did, even though I know that a fair number of my readers, you know, like my baseball bat upside the head, you know, yeah, that's what they're expecting out of me. And I've heard from a couple of them, you know, I've heard from a couple of them saying, it's kind of soft, Char.
But there are copious motherfuckers, as we've established.
Yes, they are copious motherfuckers.
So therefore, right, you can kind of get away with your heart on your sleeve, provided the grit itself is there in the dialogue.
Yeah, there's copious motherfuckers, and there's, you know, Webb is not the usual, you know, hard drinking, drug taking protagonist of my stories. He's actually not at all that, and he talks about it, and he's got a reason for that. And there is violence, and there are a couple gruesome scenes. More what we see is the after effects of violence or, you know, human demise. That's where most of the grotesquerie comes in. The descriptions of actual violence, there's only one real bloody act of violence that we see on the page in the book. Everything else is, you kind of see the fluids, or you see that something bad is going to start, but you don't get to see what happens afterwards. And again, that was a conscious choice on my part. You know, I wanted to do that. I wanted to change it up. I wanted to relax a little bit, and it worked. It was really good for me, man. Yeah. It was really good for me. And I'm really glad I did it when I did it, because the book that I referenced earlier that I finished up recently is far and away the darkest thing that I've ever written. Not the most violent, but easily the darkest thing that I've ever written. And it was good to come off of this book before I went into that book. And it's because it does, you know, you live with those thoughts, you have them in your head, and it's not like you become insufferable. It's not some Stephen King dark half scenario where, you know, the evil guy manifests or anything. It's just, it just becomes tiring. And there's also just a creative aspect of it. It becomes leaden if you do it over and over and over again, and it's too easy to slip into habit and not make an additional effort. So
I had a minor pedantic question, but I noticed the dashes in this book were lined up in such a way so that they matched the paragraph marks.
Yeah,
was that your doing?
No, you know what that was? I'll tell you exactly what that was. That was a big, fat. Yeah, this is not because I'm super cool. This is because they're prescription.
Yeah.
That was a typesetting fuck up, is what that
really?
Was. They blew it in the whole book. And nobody caught it. It was in the notes, the proofed manuscript.
Yeah.
And for some reason, when we got the typeset, they give you a sample sheaf of typeset pages that show you all the different, you know, way different types for the book. And for some reason, neither my editor or I caught it. And the first time I cracked the book, I went, wait a minute, that looks weird.
Yeah.
Why does that look?
I thought
bit
that
wrong?
That was a deliberate effort. It's like, no, this is now a new Charlie Houston novel. Suddenly, okay.
No, it just slipped through the cracks.
I must also ask you, when Webb punches someone late in the book, he's quick to point out that it wasn't like a bone crunching roundhouse that would have made the Duke proud. He is then hit by this figure, who I won't name. I don't want to spoil the book. Later, with a roundhouse the Duke would have been proud of. Why is the Duke the standard with which to gauge all punches? And seeing as how he's a young man, and Rambo is mentioned earlier, I must quibble to some degree as to why you chose John Wayne over all other cinematic legends.
Well, okay, so first off, Webb does not reference Rambo. The character who hits him references Rambo. So that's his frame of his frame of reference. And Webb makes a comment when he first observes this character that he assumes that this guy has acquired his physical style from watching too many Tom Cruise movies. So that and Webb says that disparagingly, yes, which should kind of put us in frame of mind. Webb grew up in a household, in a movie-making household, and with a father who drove him around town, showing him the high points of where classic movies were filmed from all eras. So clearly he's got a background in cinematic history. Well, I think it's safe to assume that he's watched a fair amount of John Ford, John Wayne films.
But he's also resistant to those movies as well, which is why it's interesting.
Well, I don't know how resistant he is to them. Anyway, if John Wayne is not the measuring stick by which all full range, just open arm, haymaking, roundhouse punches is to be measured by, I don't know who is. I mean, he was the master of the art. You don't think of John Wayne and think of him as a rabbit punch or a jab or anything like that. John Wayne is leaning back, loading up, yeah, and letting loose all the way. So I could not possibly think, if I wanted to evoke that kind of punch, anybody other than John Wayne would.
Did
come
you even
to mind
try to think
no,
of an
no, it was the first thing that came into my head, and it was right. That's the John Wayne punch. That's the roundhouse haymaker. That's him, man, without a doubt. I wouldn't even bother.
The John Wayne punch in any capacity, or
maybe when I was 13? You know, I might have loaded up like that in a schoolyard fight, and then been hit about 5 or 6 times before you can get it around. They move slow. They move slow. It's a movie house punch. You can't get away with that in the real thing.
The fact is it's a movie punch because it's generally done so you don't hit the chin, and the camera shoots it at a particular level. So it's kind of a bullshit punch, actually.
Yeah.
When you think of,
yeah, absolutely. It's also a movie punch because it telegraphs and it reads great. You know, I mean, the guy rears back, he loads up, and then he lets loose. So it photographs well.
Well, the other question is almonds. Now, why did almonds crop up? The first thing in relation to cockroaches. Are you an almond man? Are you passionate of almonds? Have you had bad experience with almonds? Have you eaten almonds and seen cockroaches scutter in an apartment? Why, above all, almonds than, say, you know, another pecans or something?
It was almonds because when I was, because I just kind of generally float around doing the kind of web surfing research that everybody kind of does, and different things capture my attention, and I snag on them, and I save a lot of files on weird crimes and odd things, and one of the key plot points is agricultural hijacking, which is actually a major I won't say plague of crime, but there's a lot of it in the Central Valley of California, and very specifically, there was an article about almond trucks being, loads of almonds, and went into some detail about the profit points on them. So it was something that, A, caught my attention, B, I hadn't read about anywhere, so I liked it from that point of view, C, fit my sensibility both as a person and as a writer. I think it fit in well with the kind of criminals that I tend to write about. And I just liked it. So I did some research, and I learned about the task forces that work agricultural crime, and kind of how a little bit about how these guys operate and stuff. So that was it. You know, no, I got nothing against almonds. Me and almonds get along just fine.
You've never had a bad almond experience?
No, I can't think of one. I mean, I was never the kid that shoved almonds up my nose or anything
Okay. The other question I have, what was it? Oh, actually, going back to words, you're a big fan of using okay, obviously, in the dialogue, but there's one point in which you use okay with 6 A's, and you capitalize the K, which is interesting because you're not really a transcribed speech guy. You italicize.
Right.
The lines itself generally speak for themselves, but in this case, a rare moment in which there is the okay. So I'm curious as to why that particular moment arose, whether we could expect more.
I can't remember it in the book, so I'm not certain where it is. I'm sure I just wanted it to be able to, so it sounded like okay or something. I'd have to see the line to know exactly. I just was trying to, evoke the way it sounded when somebody said it, or if it was an internal thing, I just wanted it to kind of, I don't know, I don't know. I don't. Just one of those moments.
Yeah, you're not interested in doing further transcribed speech beyond what you're currently doing, or
had never occurred to me to think of it as that. So, okay. I have to say no.
Post in. He's a big Slim Jim man.
Yeah.
Why Slim Jim over Doritos?
Because he's got a cheesy puff, you know, scene later. So Doritos would have been kind of redundant. I don't know. Why Slim Jim's over a Dorito? Easier to talk with a Slim Jim in your mouth, maybe?
A sort of surrogate for a cigar?
No, just a Slim Jim, you know? Just a Slim Jim. It just, you know, you think about, like, the nastiest things that you can put in your face, you know? And it's like Slim Jim is right up there, man. That's like, they're good eating, but they're, in terms of just being something kind of grossly unhealthy, and that was the main thing, was just kind of to get the ball rolling on Posin, that he's not just fat, he's, you know... He's unwell.
When was the last time you had a Slim Jim?
Too long. Probably been, literally been years,
you're
I would
long?
Imagine.
You're longing for a Slim Jim?
I'm not longing for a Slim Jim. Every now and then when I'm at the counter at, you know, the grocery store or whatever, and I see the little, you know, stands of sulfate packed, you know, nitrate infused pig's anuses that have been molded into spears of delight. You know, I get a little tinkle in my eye.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you quickly about the research. You mentioned that you did web research. Did you do a lot of phoning? Did you talk to people for this?
For the crime scene cleaning, I interviewed a couple people for that. That was I've never, you know, the books are generally at a far enough remove from reality that I can, you know, I can get away with futzing a lot of stuff, and it doesn't bother me because it's fiction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's always funny to me how people are willing to embrace the idea of a vampire underworld, but you know, within that same context, if you get the make and model of the car wrong, you know, you get emails being like, hey man, they don't even make that car. It's like,
well,
but there aren't even really vampires either, so what the fuck, who cares. But this was a little bit, once I kind of knew that I wanted to do the trauma scene and have that be the profession that Webb drifted into, it's two. You can't make that up. It's two things. A, you're gonna say something stupid. You're gonna, you know, it's a job that's clearly too specialized to just try and think about how they might do that and make it sound cool. You need to have some details. B, for that same reason, you know that if you do some research into it, you're gonna discover some details that are just gonna be gold. And that you're going to be able to, you know, work whole reams of material off of just little tiny things. So it's just necessary. I had to do some research and talk to some people. So I'd read some articles and stuff, found some folks that were local to Los Angeles, and they were wonderful. I ended up spending a couple days with them, doing some interviews with them and learning a lot about what they did and how they came to do it. And a lot of their, a lot of their insights into the profession, a lot of what they told me about how it works, and some of their actual anecdotes about jobs they'd been on are in the book.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Well, Charlie, thanks so much for taking the time. It was
my pleasure
chatting with you.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah.